So last weekend, Lori and I happened to watch a little bit of the Memorial Day concert from Washington, D.C. And near the end of that concert, they told the story of Army Captain Luis Avila and his wife, Claudia. 2011, Captain Avila was in Afghanistan on his fifth overseas deployment. As he and his team were traveling one day, a massive IED exploded directly under their vehicle. Three of his teammates were killed instantly. The rest were severely wounded, including Captain Avila. He sustained wounds to his left leg so severe that it had to be amputated. He suffered traumatic brain injury, and the overall damage to his body was so traumatic that he suffered two heart attacks and two strokes, put him into a coma, and he's in a coma for 40 days. The doctors basically said there's no hope. Told his wife, we're going to have to remove him from life support. He's not going to survive. Well, she insisted that they leave him on life support, and miraculously, after 40 days, he regained consciousness, but had serious brain damage, was paralyzed, and his wife, Claudia, has stuck with him for these last 6 years and nursed him through a terribly difficult process of therapy and rehabilitation. He'll never be the same. He cannot speak very well. He cannot care for himself, but she loves him, and she has stuck with him and been faithful to him through a very, very difficult process, and is going to have to be faithful to him for the rest of his life, even though there are so many things that he can no longer do. She daily lives out a remarkable loyalty, love, and faithfulness. Recently watched on TV the closing moments of the movie Black Hawk Down, which you all know tells the horrifying story of the fierce firefight that was the Battle of Mogadishu, that lasted a day and a half and resulted in the death of 18 American soldiers and probably more than 1,000 Somali enemy. Near the end of the movie, there's a scene that is actually based on an event that actually occurred. The battle was essentially over, and after they had escaped this hellacious battle, one Ranger soldier is talking to one of the Delta operators, Delta soldier, and he's amazed to see that this Delta soldier is actually gearing up to go back into the city because there was one American soldier still unaccounted for. And the Delta guy says to this Ranger soldier, you know, back home, people ask me, why do you do it? Why do you go fight someone else's war? I don't say anything to them because they won't understand. It's about the man next to you. It's all about loyalty. There's something deep within us that is touched and inspired by loyalty, by one person sacrificing his or her own good for another and sticking with that person through whatever may come. Perhaps it's because we long for that ourselves. We long for someone to be that loyal person to us who will stand with us and always be there for us. We want to know that we're not alone in this world. One of the great stories of loyalty is we're in a series here of sermons where we're thinking about some game changers from the Bible, people who made a difference in this world for other people. Well, one of those people was Ruth. It's one of the great stories of loyalty, probably a story you're familiar with, but I want us to think about that story this morning. Ruth 1:1 says, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So the story of Ruth takes place during the time of the judges of Israel. It's a time before Israel had a king, before Saul became the first king of Israel. So we're talking about somewhere prior to 1000 BC. This was a period where Israel, without a king, was ruled by a series of judges that God would raise up. However, Judges 17:6 says, in those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. Literally, the text says, each one did what was right in his own eyes. Now, that's a philosophy or an approach to life that would be really popular in our culture today. Our society is committed to the idea that there is no absolute truth. There is no absolute objective standard of moral right and wrong. And so each person decides what is right and what is wrong for himself or herself. And that will be different for each individual. And this idea is celebrated as this is what's going to set us free. We don't have to answer to what somebody else thinks is right or wrong. Now, maybe you saw there's been a commercial on TV that depicts this. It's a commercial, oddly, for a car. And in the car, it features people singing the old song, You Don't Own Me. Have you seen this? You know, you don't own me. Don't try to change me in any way. Don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me what to say. You know, just let me be myself. That's the moral of our culture. I don't get what that has to do with buying a car. But you get the point. Nobody tells me what's right or wrong. I determine everything for myself. Nobody controls me. That's what our culture wants to believe. And that's what was happening in the days of the judges of Israel. They didn't have the written law of Moses at that point. They didn't have a Bible that they could read. And they didn't have a king telling them what to do. So they did whatever they felt was right in their own eyes, which people in our culture think is really cool. However, Judges 3:7 says, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And that exact same phrase shows up, or sentence shows up again in verse 17 in that chapter, and then in chapter 4, verse 1, and Judges chapter 6, verse 1, over and over, Israel did what was evil. Here's the problem. This should serve as a cautionary tale for us that when people do whatever is right in their own eyes, they often do evil. A couple of months ago, I called to do jury duty. You know, you go up to Vista and there's this big complex of buildings, thousands of people going there every day to do activities that are there because people are doing what is right in their own eyes and they're doing evil, a lot of it. That had some serious implications for what Ruth was going to have to face in her day. It has some serious implications for women, as you're going to see. So let's look at Ruth chapter 1, verses 6 through 22, that give kind of a capsule picture of what is kind of the core of Ruth's story. So we got that passage there? There we go. Okay. When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. Then she kissed them goodbye, and they wept aloud and said to her, we will go back with you to your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who would become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I'm too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters. It's more bitter for me than for you because the Lord's hand has turned against me. At this, they wept aloud again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women exclaimed, can this be Naomi? Don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. Okay, so what happens in the story of Ruth that you probably know is that Naomi's sweet life turned bitter. A little background, Naomi was a Jewish woman married to a man named Elimelech. They had two sons, but then a terrible recession hit the nation of Israel. Back then it was called a famine, but the bottom line was things were really bad. You know, the recession of 2008 has been the worst that has happened in my lifetime, which at this point encompasses a lot of territory. But there was one actually that hit, a recession that hit in 1989 that had a big impact on Lori's and my life. Because we figured out in that 1 year alone, one quarter of the congregation of our church at that time had to move out of this area because they couldn't survive here because conditions were so bad. Many of our good friends, people who had had their children when we had ours and went through some of the most difficult times of our life with us, had to move away, and they're now scattered across the United States. They're in Nebraska and Iowa and Illinois and Washington and lots of different places. Well, that's what happened to Elimelech and Naomi. They essentially lost everything and determined they could no longer survive in Israel. They feared if they stayed there, they were going to starve to death. So they moved to a neighboring country called Moab. Now, that was clearly an act of desperation because Moab and Israel did not get along. In fact, there was just off and on enmity between them. In Deuteronomy 23:3, it says, "No Ammonite or Moabite or any of their descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord, not even in the 10th generation." It says, we're not going to allow any of them in here, not for hundreds of years, any of those Moabites. So it's kind of interesting that they went to Moab because Moab actually was east of Israel. And so you would think, well, you know, if the weather was bad, if there were droughts causing famine in Israel, then they were going to affect Moab because Moab actually is a little more arid than is Israel itself. So I suspect that there was something else other than just a weather-driven famine going on. I think it had to do with something you see in Judges chapter 6, verses 3 and 4, which says, "Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, the Midianites and Amalekites and other eastern peoples invaded their country. They camped in the land and ruined all the crops all the way to Gaza and did not spare a living thing for Israel." So Israel was being constantly invaded by people who would come and they would destroy their crops. And Moab apparently wasn't being equally invaded. Therefore, they had food. Israel didn't. So you got this tough move for the family. They got to leave their home. They leave their land, which was the source of income in that agrarian society. Move to a place where they didn't know anyone, and they were not especially welcome. In fact, they were not particularly fond of Israelis, and they were going to have to start from scratch in that foreign culture. Sadly, things got worse for poor Naomi. After 10 years of living there, Naomi's husband died, and then shortly thereafter, both of her sons died. Neither of them had had children with their wives. They had married local Moabite women and didn't have any sons. So we don't know what was going on in Moab, but it sure was bad for the men in Naomi's family because they all died. So her situation at that point was about as desperate as it could possibly have been. In that society, women were totally dependent upon men to support them. They couldn't go out and get a job, and they couldn't own land. They weren't allowed to own land, and land was the source of income, like I said. And so they survived. Basically, a woman would start off being supported by her father, and then she would get married and be supported by her husband, and hopefully would have sons so that if her husband died, her sons could inherit the land, and she'd still have land and be able to be supported. Naomi is in a bad situation because she's old enough that her father has died, and now her husband has died, and now her sons have died. She has no means of support. She is in trouble big time. She's going to be destitute. That brings us to verse 6, and that tells us that Naomi heard at that time that the Lord, quote, had come to the aid of his people by providing for them. In other words, things had gotten economically better in Israel. And so Naomi decides, I'd better go back to Israel. She probably decided that because she may have thought, well, you know, I do have some extended family there. Maybe they'll take sympathy on me and they'll help me out. Furthermore, Israel had some laws. They didn't keep them very well, but they had laws that were provided a safety net for the those who were destitute. So there was some semblance of those laws that would provide possibly for a widow like her. So here's this poor woman. She's going to go back to Israel. She's suffering grief over the death of her husband and her sons, unimaginable pile of grief. And on top of that, she's dealing with incredible financial pressure. So you notice in verse 20 how she felt when she got back to Bethlehem. And everybody said, oh, can this be Naomi? And she said, well, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. Well, the name Naomi means sweet. So back in ancient Israel, you know, when if somebody said, hey, look at my sweet ride, they would have said, look at my Naomi ride. You know, it is Naomi, it is sweet, you know. Well, Naomi said, don't call me sweet anymore because my life is no longer sweet. It is now bitter. That's what Mara means. And, you know, she says, the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but he has brought me back empty. He has brought misfortune upon me. Man, this poor woman is bitter. She had a very theological outlook on life. She understood that God is very real and God is sovereign, and that the things that happened to her have happened because God has brought them into her life. He has allowed these things to happen to her. Unfortunately, she displays something that kind of happens to most of us, and that is when things start going bad like that, we tend to exaggerate a little bit. You know, it's all bad. It's not just, I got a few bad things happening in my life. My whole life is black. It's hopeless. There's never going to be any good in my life. Woe is me. I might as well die. Well, that's kind of where Naomi was. God is actually at work in Naomi's life. She can't see it yet. In fact, there are some things that happen in this passage that are God at work. And it's going to be pretty cool how it all turns out. But at this point, she's just saying, God basically hates me. That's kind of where she is. Enter Ruth. Ruth comes into the story, and Ruth chose loyalty and sacrifice. Now, Ruth is one of Naomi's daughters-in-law, and she also knew the heartache, pain. Her husband had died, so she is crushed by that, and she also is in an unenviable situation because, you know, she can't own land either. When Naomi announces that she's going to return to Bethlehem, Ruth and her sister-in-law Orpah announce they're going to go with her. Naomi says, no, you can't do that. You got to stay here. But Orpah says, you're right, I'm going to stay here. Ruth was not to be denied. She insists on going with Naomi. Now, this is quite remarkable. Remember, this is a woman insisting on immigrating to a foreign land in order to stay with her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law, you know. You know what the punishment for bigamy is? Two mothers-in-law. You know, that's 1 year a woman bought her mother-in-law a cemetery plot for her birthday. And the next year the mother-in-law was hurt when the daughter-in-law didn't give her a present on her birthday. And she said, well, why didn't you give me anything this year? And the daughter-in-law said, well, because you haven't used the gift I gave you last year. Yeah, okay, you know, we all know the mother-in-law jokes, you know. This was a relationship that was not the stereotypical. Ruth loved her mother-in-law, and her mother-in-law loved her like a daughter. You know, Lori is now a little sensitive to mother-in-law jokes because she is one. She's a mother-in-law. She says, it's kind of weird to be a mother-in-law. But you know what? Lori is not a typical mother-in-law. She loves her daughter-in-law and her son-in-law to death. And they know that they are loved by her and they are fortunate to have her. And that's the way Ruth was with Naomi. You know, Naomi demonstrates her love for these women in insisting, you know, it would be better for her if her daughters-in-law stuck with her, they could help her in some way maybe. But she insisted, no, you stay here because you've got a chance to get married again. You know, Naomi's entire stay in Moab was 10 years. It's likely that her sons didn't get married probably for the first 2 or 3 years that they were in Moab before they could actually get to know people and arrange marriages for them. Maybe as much as 4 years. And remember in those days that young women, women got married very young, usually in their early teens. So Ruth was probably 14-ish when she got married. So she's maybe been married 6 years. That means she's about 20 years old. Very marriageable at that age for her. So for her, it would have made lots of sense to just stay in Moab. She could have found another husband and gone on with her life. Instead, she chose to go back to Israel with Naomi. And that's a pretty remarkable choice. What amazing statements. Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. I'm going to worship the true God, the God of Israel, because I know he's the real God. May he deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates us. I won't allow anything to separate us. Ruth was committed to sticking with Naomi, even though it would cost her. You know, it's interesting that Naomi painted a pretty hopeless, bleak picture of her life. And Ruth didn't go, oh, come on, it's not that bad. It was that bad. And she said, I don't care, I'm coming with you anyway. And you need to think about what that meant for Ruth. She was never going to see her home again, never going to see her family again, probably would not even get to go back and visit. She would have to give up the culture that she had had all of her life. She's trading in her the religion that she was raised with for the religion, the worship of the true God. And it meant going to a place where she was going to face some pretty stiff prejudice. And there is another element here that it lies a little bit below the surface, and it's easy for us to miss. In chapter 2 of Ruth, verses 8 and 9, Ruth is, when she goes to Israel with Naomi, one of the ways that they're going to take care of themselves is they're going to go into fields. It was permitted for widows to go into fields that had already been harvested, and there would be some crop left over, and they would go in and basically harvest the leftovers. So she was doing that in the field of a wealthy man named Boaz. And verses 8 and 9, Boaz says this to her, listen carefully, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field. Furthermore, do not go from this one, but stay here with my maids. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Indeed, I have commanded the servants not to touch you. Now, there's two things in those verses that are important for us to pay attention to. He says, don't go into another field. You stay right here in my fields. And secondly, he says, I've commanded my servants not to touch you. Now, why is that? Why did he say those things to her? He had to do that because it wasn't safe for her if she went into other fields. And unless Boaz commanded his servants, it wouldn't be safe for her in his fields. In Ruth chapter 2, verse 22, Naomi encouraged Ruth to stay in the fields of Boaz. She said this, it will be good for you, my daughter, to go with the women who work for him, because in someone else's field, you might be harmed. Why? Because everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Israel at that point wasn't living by God's divine truth. They were doing whatever seemed right to them. And it would likely seem right to some men to take advantage of a single young woman. The only thing that would keep men from doing that in that culture was the threat of reprisal. If they attacked a single young Israeli woman, they knew that her family, her clan, would take revenge on them. Ruth had no family and clan in Israel. Therefore, there was no fear of someone taking revenge on them. So Ruth was seriously at risk. Boaz had to warn his own men, you leave that woman alone. Because if he didn't, someone was going to take advantage of her. If she wandered into someone else's field, she would be at risk because someone was going to attack her. That's what happens when everyone does what is right in their own eyes. You know, there's a strange, inconsistent thing going on in our culture. Our society, as we all know, wants to say, well, there's no truth, there's no divine revelation, there's no absolute right or wrong. Each person wants to do what is right in his own eyes, just like in Ruth's day. Nobody has the right to tell us what is right or wrong. But have you noticed that there is a big hue and cry, strident outcry against any hint today of sexual harassment or sexual assault against women? Cases of Bill Cosby, Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, and a steady stream of high-profile athletes. Here's the problem. How do you say that sexual assault or sexual harassment is wrong if there is no wrong? Where do you get that? Don't you think the person who does the harassing, for him, he thinks that's right? And who are you to tell him it's wrong? Oh, well, but see, when you do something like that, you hurt another person. So, where is it written that that's wrong? What moral code did that come from? If someone doesn't think it's wrong to hurt another person, in his eyes that's right, then that should be right for him. Who are we to tell him it's wrong? Our culture is running into a problem predicted long ago by C.S. Lewis in his book, The Abolition of Man. In that book, he depicted the chest of a person as the seat of a heart governed by divine moral truth. And he said it is the chest, the heart ruled by God's truth, that is the only safeguard against us becoming animals. He wrote that our culture has done, quote, what it has done is, quote, in a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue. At some point, it is possible that women in our culture are going to figure out that they have made a terrible bargain by buying into the moral relativity of our society. In an environment where there is no moral truth, something is going to fill the vacuum. Do you know what will fill the vacuum? It's power. People will do whatever they have the power to do. Because men are physically stronger and therefore more physically powerful than women, guess what that means? It's bad news for women. You know, there's a huge emphasis, you probably noticed, on girl power in our society. Why does that exist? Because if there is no right or wrong, all that is left is power. And if all that exists is power, women lose. So we have to somehow make women more powerful. Here's the bad news. It's not going to work. It can't solve the problem. The problem is way deeper than telling women, you're powerful, men are still stronger. It's not going to work. If our culture wants to believe there's no right or wrong, then it better be prepared to accept the horrifying consequences that come with it. I think a much better idea is to accept that God has revealed some moral truth to us. And in our heart of hearts, everybody knows it. We know there's right and wrong. God has revealed moral truth that says sexually harassing anyone, sexually assaulting women is wrong. And we ignore God's truth to our peril. Now, that was kind of a side trail there. That was all for free. We're going to go back now to Ruth's story. What I want you to get is that Ruth understood, going back to Israel, that is what she was facing. And she did it anyway. She wasn't risking just that it was going to be inconvenient and uncomfortable and difficult for her. She was risking her own safety. And she did it anyway. because she was so loyal to her mother-in-law. Isn't that an amazing story? Now, here's the cool thing. God gave a happy ending to the story. You know, what a terrible story it would have been if had Ruth and Naomi gone to Israel and starved to death there, or managed to just somehow eke out a living, you know, and eventually died widows. But this story has a Hollywood ending, and I love it. So Ruth just happens, when they get there, to go to the fields of this wealthy man named Boaz, who had been away, and he gets back to his home and to his fields the day that Ruth starts gleaning his fields. And in chapter 2, verse 5, when Boaz saw her, he asked one of his managers, "Who does that woman belong to?" Let me translate that for you. The English translation of that would be, "Whoa, who is that chick? And is she married? Whoa." You know, in good romantic comedies, you know how you know that in the end, when you see the leading man, the leading woman meet, you know, they may be even in conflict, but you know somehow they're going to get together. You know, the test of a good romantic comedy is how much chemistry is between the man and the woman. And you know that there's going to be obstacles and there's going to be conflict, but somehow in the end, they're going to get together, right? That's what happens when Boaz sees Ruth. As soon as you see him say, "Who is that chick?" you go, "He's the love interest. They're going to get together. This is so cool." You know, this is like when Buttercup sees Wesley in the Princess Bride, and she may call him farm boy, and she may treat him badly, and you know, she might get into the clutches of the evil prince, and he might be captured by the dread pirate Roberts, but you know, somehow in the end, they're going to get together. That's Boaz and Ruth. And sure enough, in chapter 4, verse 13, it says, "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife." There were some obstacles they had to overcome, but they overcame them. They got married. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. Ruth had dark days. Naomi had dark days. But in the end, verse 14 says, "The women said to Naomi, 'Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian, redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel.'" And in verse 17, it ends with the words about Ruth's son. "They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David." Not only did Ruth get married, not only did she have a son, but she became eventually the great-grandmother of Israel's greatest king, David himself. Okay, cool. Love happy endings. This story has a happy Hollywood ending. So what? What does it say to us? It has a lot to say to us. And the first thing it says to us, I think, is we should be as loyal as Ruth was. You know, what makes this a beautiful story is the loyalty and the faithfulness of Ruth. Her determination to seek the good of her mother-in-law is touching and inspiring, and it changed everything. It even changed history. Ruth ultimately had an impact on the human race, as you're going to see. Proverbs 17:17 says, "A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity." A real friend is loyalty, and we all long for that. You know, that's why in the movies, you know, Frodo had Sam in Lord of the Rings, and Sherlock Holmes has Watson, Butch Cassidy had Sundance Kid, Batman has Robin, you know, 21 Jump Street and Lethal Weapon, there's always two guys together. Even the Lone Ranger wasn't actually lone. He had Tonto, you know. Two together. If we're going to be game changers, though, we all understand that we have this longing for that loyal friend. If we're going to be great game changers, we're not going to have to just long for a loyal friend. We're going to have to be the loyal friend. Proverbs 20, verse 6 says, "Many claim to have unfailing love, but a faithful person, who can find?" You know what? They're very rare. That's what that passage says. But if you're a follower of Jesus Christ, You are called to be an imitator of Him. You're to be called to be an imitator of God. Do you know what God is like? Deuteronomy 7:9 says, "Know therefore that the Lord your God is God. He is the faithful God, keeping His covenant of love to 1,000 generations of those who love Him and keep His commandments." Romans 8:38-39 tells us nothing will ever separate us from His love. Nothing. God is the most loyal, faithful person in all that exists. You have never known anyone that is as faithful and as loyal as God is. And the fact is that our ability to have a relationship with Him is totally dependent upon His loyalty and His faithfulness. All around us, as you look around, as you think about people in the world, there are people who are longing for someone to be in their corner, to be loyal and faithful to them. They're desperate to find someone in whom the love of God is so alive that it has transformed that person to become like God in His faithfulness. Someone who will say to them, "Nothing is ever going to separate me from you," like Ruth said to Naomi. "May God deal with me severely if even death separates us. That's how committed to you I am." Laura and I recently watched the movie Passengers. It's an interesting movie. It depicts a futuristic story. It has this spaceship called Avalon that is the center of it. This spaceship carries 5,000 people who are going to be colonists on a new planet. The problem is that the journey to this new planet takes 120 years. And so the way they deal with this is they've got technology to put people in these hibernation pods, and they put them in suspended animation so they're asleep, suspended, and so they don't age. And so they're going to be asleep for the entire 120-year journey and just wake up when they're 4 months away from the end of the journey. However, so the ship is totally automated. So it's going through space, and it runs into a dense belt of asteroids that cause damage to the ship. And it doesn't seem initially that the damage is that bad, but one of the effects it has is it causes one of those pods, hibernation pods, to malfunction. And it opens up, and the guy awakes when they're only 30 years into the journey. And he is alone on this ship facing the next 90 years all by himself. And he tries, his name is Jim Parsons. Jim runs all around trying to figure out what he can do to try to put himself back in hibernation or get some kind of help. Because he, you know, the idea of being alone on that ship all by himself 90 years is horrifying. Finally, after a year, he can't stand it anymore. He can't fix the problem. But he has noticed this one woman in a pod. And as he's read a little bit about her background, he realizes, I need companionship. And he opens her pod. And she wakes up. Now, when she first wakes up, she thinks that the same thing has happened to her that's happened to him. It's been an accident. And she's been awakened at the same time. And so they go through, she tries to figure out, oh, what can we do? And nothing works. But over time, as the two of them are together, a love relationship develops. And they begin to, it becomes clear, you know, it's again, you know, the chemistry, it's there. They love each other until one day she discovers that her being awake is no accident, that he had awakened her. And she is angry. She is furious at him. She despises him for what he's done to her because she had dreams of what she was going to do on this planet. She's a writer, and she was going to document all about what they were going to do, and all of that is now gone. Well, as it turns out, in the story, the damage that was done to the ship was actually more severe than it initially seemed, and as time goes by, as a couple of years pass, slowly the ship's systems begin to degrade until it becomes apparent the ship is about to blow up, killing everyone on board. Well, Jim and Aurora go, and then they save the ship. They were able to fix the problem. They save the ship and save all the lives. And when that crisis is passed, Jim eventually figures out a way to fix one more pod that's in the sick bay, a medical pod, so that Aurora could go back in that pod go back into hibernation until the ship arrives, and he would live out the rest of his life alone. And Aurora chooses not to go. She chooses to stay awake and live her life with the man she loves. Even though it's going to be difficult, and even though it's going to cost her something, she does it because of her love and her loyalty. The message, I love the message of that. Lori gets annoyed because I keep hammering on the movie La La Land. Has the wrong message. La La Land says, all that matters, relationships are expendable, and what matters is your dream and your glory. Passengers says, that's wrong. What matters is people and relationships and love. And that's what Ruth displays for us. So here's the question. To whom are you loyal like that? Who in this world knows that they can count on you no matter what? There's an important thing I think that we need to notice in this passage, though, in this story of Ruth, and that is, in order for us to be that loyal, we're going to need the faith of Ruth. Loyalty actually often doesn't make sense if God is not being the focal point of our lives. Our natural human bent is to pursue self-interest. I do what's best for me. And had Ruth done that, she would have jettisoned Naomi and gone off on with her life and probably would have found another husband. You know, going to Israel didn't hold out a lot of promise for her to find another husband because pre-owned Moabite wives were not in much demand, you know. Ruth's choice only makes sense when we factor in her faith in the God of Israel. Now you may be thinking, well, where do you get that? Ruth chapter 2 verse 12, Boaz said to Ruth, may you be richly rewarded for the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Ruth went to Israel with the mindset, I'm taking refuge under the wings of the Almighty God of Israel. He is going to take care of me. That's what gave her the strength to be loyal and to make the sacrifice, take the risk of loving Naomi, because she trusted that whatever God did would take care of her. She entrusted her life to God. Without God being at the center of our motives for everything we do, self-sacrifice doesn't make much sense. What is reasonable is take care of yourself. You know, you should sometime, you know, our son Toby and his wife Anna, they have a couple of dogs. Sometime you should watch those dogs. Please. You take it. No, I'm just kidding. They have two dogs, Doc and Banjo. Banjo is the bigger of the two. And generally can force his will on Doc if he so chooses. Now, Doc kind of thinks he's the leader of the pack and tries to be the dominant dog, but it just doesn't work, you know. So we gave dog chew bones, you know, those rawhide bones to the two dogs. We gave them one each. Well, we noticed an interesting thing happened. Banjo just wanted, the bone that he wanted was whatever one Doc had. So, you know, we'd go, here's one Banjo and here's one Doc, and Banjo would just ignore his and go actually take the bone out of Doc's mouth. And then Doc would go get the other bone, then Banjo would drop that bone and go get that bone out of Doc's mouth. Whatever Doc had, Banjo would go get it. Banjo saying, I'm taking care of me. I want, if somebody's got something else, I want it. I'm going to go get it. He's operating on instinct. He doesn't have any thought of, what does God want in this situation? You know, how can I love Doc, you know, here? He's not thinking about that. He's just thinking about Banjo. And sadly, if we don't have God as the focal point of our lives, that's how human nature ought to operate too. Take care of me. That's what makes the most sense. Self-sacrifice, only if I see a greater good coming back to me somewhere down the road. True sacrifice, where I just say, I'm not, this is not about me, this is about loving you, derives from a solid faith that God is going to provide for me and God is going to take care of me and what God is going to supply for me is enough. I rely upon that, and that's what sets me free to give up myself to sacrifice. Here's how you do that. You envision yourself standing before the cross of Jesus Christ. Jesus was on that cross because of his loyalty first to his Father and then secondly to us. He loves us. It was not to his advantage to be there. It was as much to his disadvantage as it could possibly be. But he went there because he loves us. When others let you down, when they're faithless or flawed so much they disappoint you, you look at Jesus Christ and you on the cross, you say, oh, that's right. I'm not faithful to him as much as I should be, but still he's on that cross for me. He still loves me. To this day he loves me and will never stop loving me. And that is the model, that is the picture I keep in my mind that I use for how I relate to other people. It is the cross of Jesus Christ. But one more thing that can help you here, and that is that we should remember that when we do this, when we trust in God and use our lives to be loyal and faithful to love others, God will make our lives matter. Here's the thing that's amazing. Because of her loyalty, you know, Ruth, just imagine, let's suppose that she hadn't been loyal to Naomi and she just said, yeah, you know what, I'm staying here, wish you all the best. She got married to some other Moabite guy. Guess what would have happened? You'd have never heard about her. She'd have lived out her life, been some Moabite woman with a husband and maybe some kids, and that would have been the end of it. Because of her faithfulness to God and to Naomi, do you know who she turned out to be? Yeah, we said, oh, she's the great-grandmother of David. Yeah, she's more than that. In Matthew chapter 1, verse 5, there's a part of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, and it says this. It lists Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab, Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth, Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David, and you go on down the list until you get to Jesus Christ. Ruth was the ancestor of Jesus Christ, who changed the entire world. Ruth changed the world because of her faithfulness. She changed our lives. The Messiah, our Savior, came because of her. How cool is that? Ruth never knew. Ruth didn't know how important she was in human history. She never knew that. But she had eternal significance by making the sacrifice that she made. You know, I mentioned the movie Passengers. It's interesting that there's one point in the movie where the woman, the lead character, Aurora, who's a writer, is reading some of her writings. And at one point, she says it seems to her, this is where the title of the movie came from, she says, sometimes it seems to me like we are passengers in our own lives being moved along to some unforeseen destination. It's true. God is at work moving us along. We're almost like passengers in our own lives when we trust in God and let him work. We've seen it in the life of Esther, and now we see it again in Ruth. God is at work doing things that we could never even imagine as we trust in him. Proverbs 16:9 says, in their hearts, humans plan their course, but the Lord establishes their steps. Don't you have a sense that you are intended for something great? Don't you have a sense that somehow there was a destiny for you in life? And I think a lot of us struggle because we kind of look at our lives and we think something great or a destiny means something that will be noticeable to other people and big, and it didn't happen, and we're a little bit disappointed that somehow I wasn't as famous, as important, as powerful as I thought I was going to be. It's not what it's about at all. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 17 says, as we trust in God and follow Him, we are achieving an eternal glory that far outweighs anything in this world. God does have a destiny for you and for me, an eternal glory. You are intended for something great. And the way to get it is to go along with God's plan for your life. Trust in Him. Obey Him. And you'll find that God is moving you and He will do things that you could never imagine. And as in the case of Ruth, maybe things that you won't ever even in this life know what God has done with you. But God is doing something that in eternity you will look at and you'll go, wow, how cool was that? I didn't know. And it's just so neat. It's just so amazing. And God is saying, well done, faithful servant. There will be glory for you. You have a destiny. So go with God as He takes you on this ride. Trust in Him and give up self to serve others with your faithfulness and your loyalty. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank You for this great story of Ruth and this example of tremendous loyalty and faithfulness. But it, even as we think about it, we see that Ruth really was just reflecting a much greater loyalty that You have. The loyalty, the faithfulness of Jesus Christ hanging on a cross to bring life to people who were unfaithful, who were rejecting Him even, who were cold to Him. He still loved, He still cared, and You still love us, Lord. So we thank You for Your faithfulness to us. And we pray that we will let Your love not just stop in our lives, but flow through us to others as we become loyal to them. We pray this in the name of our great Lord Jesus. Amen.